Welcome back to Rightscast, a podcast from the Human Rights Centre at the University of Essex. Graham Dorset is a former police officer who now uses his experience to advise on policing and human rights issues. He is currently a member of the Advisory Council for the Development of a Universal Protocol for Investigative Interviewing, led by the Association for the Prevention of Torture, the Anti-Torture Initiative, and the Norwegian Centre for Human Rights. In this episode, he joins Dara Murray to discuss the importance of ethical, non-coercive interviewing practices.
Welcome. I'm joined today by Graham Dorset, and we're going to talk about interrogation, which is unusual in this environment. So maybe you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I'll come back and pick you up on the use of the word interrogation in a minute, but I'll start off, as you've asked me to, by introducing myself. My name is Graham Dorset. I was for 30 years a serving police officer in Essex, in the county of Essex. I retired way back in 1989 at a fairly senior rank. I'd experienced all sorts of types of policing during my career, and that included, towards the end of it with the senior rank, being responsible for the delivery of policing in a geographic area. I was responsible for some policy making, and also just before I retired, my last job was to head what was then called the Complaints and Discipline Department, which looked at internal misdemeanours, allegations within the force or complaints by members of the public, and had them investigated. So I've got quite a wide experience base. Since retirement, I have always had a vague interest in human rights, although I didn't understand it. And before I retired, I started making inquiries, as a result of which I then opted to spend a good sum of money from my retirement fund to come to Essex and do an LLM, which I really enjoyed. I was about the oldest student on the course that year. And since I graduated with that, I've worked as an independent consultant, really, in the policing and human rights area, working for a whole range of different universities, including this one, working for NGOs and working for international organisations all around the world.
What brought you to human rights in the first instance?
Well, I was fortunate. Whilst a serving police officer, I had occasion to go overseas on working to Cambodia, which sounds unusual, and
in
it was 80s. Unusual. Yep.
Oh, wow.
And I worked in that country for a couple of months on a specific case, which I won't go into. But it opened my eyes because I came across various components of the UN, various non-governmental organisations doing pieces of work. And to be quite frank, as a lone operator, you relied upon their advice and comradeship. And it suddenly opened my eyes to a whole industry of people trying to improve the lives of others. And that's what really made me start thinking. And what really changed me was whilst I was in Cambodia, I went and paid a visit to the secondary school called Tool Sling, which is where the Khmer Rouge tortured the people it rounded up and killed. And that was so upsetting. It was so upsetting even to reflect on it now. That made it clear to me I wanted to use part of my life to do what little I could do to try and improve the lives of other people.
Yeah, I've been there too. It's a very somber,
it's
very
an awful
somber
place.
Yeah. And were you there during the Vietnamese occupation or during the UN administration?
Just after the UN administration.
Ah, okay. Interesting. So, yeah, very interesting time kind of in the human rights movement, I guess, internationally to be there as well.
So I've had a fairly interesting and very rewarding second career.
Yeah, well, a really interesting career and a very different second one. And at the moment, you're working on a project on guidelines for non-coercive interrogation, but I may have got the name wrong if you're going to pick me up on and the interrogation element.
Well, there's a big debate about the word interrogation, and I don't like that word because interrogation for me infers strength and violence, whereas interview doesn't. But I must admit that internationally interrogation is actually the right word. You've used it correctly as English uses, but there's a debate about which words should be used. And as regards the project I'm involved in, there's still no agreement about what they should use. But I did my LLM at Essex. I did
the propaganda ticked on.
My dissertation, which was supervised by the late and wonderful Professor Sir Nigel Rodley, was on police interviewing. And I chose that topic deliberately, because interviewing, whether it's of a suspect or a witness or someone who's been involved in something, is one area, particularly with a suspect, where they're at risk. If you and I were now, one of us were interviewing the other in this room we're sitting in, which is a tiny room, mm-hmm. I could, if I felt so disposed, use aggression or use force or use threats. Mm-hmm. Which,
please don't.
Yeah. Well, I won't.
Thanks.
But the thing is, you would have no protection.
Yeah.
If you look at the international law which exists, there are various non-treaty instruments which cover, they all say don't torture someone, don't yeah. mistreat someone. There are various others which give technical advice and very loose advice on interviewing, but there is no instrument that deals with interviewing per se. And that struck me as an oddity. And it struck me as an oddity because in the latter part of my service, interviewing in the United Kingdom, which was something which was given a lot of attention. And the essence is, an interview should not necessarily be to accuse somebody and get them to admit their guilt. An interview, the principal reason for an interview should be to help establish the truth, which is a different way of looking at it.
Yeah, it sounds like a different mindset.
It is a different mindset, that's the key. And there are no rules. So I, for my dissertation, wrote about this, argued that there was a need for a specific piece of international law, and I actually drafted a very crude view of what a piece of international law would look like. Well, once I'd left the university, I tried quite hard to get two or three different international organisations interested in what I'd written. It was published in a journal on the basis that I thought it would provide a very useful piece of information. But try as I did, I couldn't get any organisation to pick it up, and largely often it was because it fell between two stools. You go to Amnesty, for example, mm-hmm. and they've got projects on X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. But if you come along with an idea that's a bit of X, a bit of Y, and a bit of Z, they don't quite know
sure.
if they've got the funding or yeah. who can handle it. So I failed. But I tried also with other organisations, didn't succeed, and just put it to one side. Then in the closing days of his position as the UN Special Rapporteur for Torture, Yuen Mende actually made exactly the same recommendation. He was unaware of my piece of work. But in one of the final pieces he presented to the UN Security Council, he argued for exactly the same. And the UN Security Council said, that sounds like a good idea. And they have asked for a piece of work to be done. So the piece of work that's being done is being done for the UN Security Council. There's a tripartite overseeing it, and the tripartite includes the APT, the mm-hmm. Association for the Prevention of Torture, the Norwegian Centre for Human Rights at Oslo, and the Centre for Human Rights in Humanitarian Law, which is based within the Washington College of Law mm-hmm. in the American University. And those three organisations jointly are overseeing this project. And there is a determination to draw up something which is useful and practical for protection on the one hand, and for facilitating good, effective policing on the other, which is the balancing point. And to that end, I mean, the project's got a 3-year life. We're only in year two. They've involved people from a wide range of legal systems, a wide range of nationalities, a wide range of experience. And a lot of consultation has taken place. And they are really alive, not only to the fact that it's got to be drafted and acceptable to all, onto the weakest link, effectively. They're actually very alive to the fact that politically it will be a challenge to get a Rolls-Royce version accepted mm-hmm. by the UN. But, of course, the saving grace is no state will say publicly, we don't like this, it's wrong.
Sure.
If they don't want it, they'll try and find ways to undermine it, I guess, in the process of adopting it. So the way the project works, there's three people manning it. There's a specific group of people who are doing the writing. There's a small steering committee, and they've appointed a number of members, of which I'm one, to an advisory council. I was really honoured to be asked, to be quite honest. And so we sit on this advisory council and just from time to time answer questions, throw in ideas, review things which have been written, pitch into debates about, for example, should it be interrogation or interview, with an argument, so that when the final thing is drafted, and I am now, they've told me the first version of the fully drafted document should be available February or March, not far away now. So I shall have an awful lot of reading and thinking to do.
And in terms of the objectives of the project, is it to provide guidance on how to conduct interviews, or is it to set the parameters that an interview can be conducted in? Do you know what I mean? What's kind of the target audience?
It's
and
to
and
do
the effect?
Both of those things.
Okay.
Now, interestingly, the premise this rests on is an interview should not be forceful. There should certainly be no threats or torture or mistreatment, mm-hmm. but it should be a conversation seeking the truth. So you can have all these grand rules saying that, but we came to the conclusion in the early days, it's no good just having grand rules saying that.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to give operatives the tools to do it. So there is now a fairly well-developed set of rules for conducting non-coercive interviews, which the police forces in the UK have used now for about 15 years okay. or so, which are all about preparing for them, knowing what you want to ask, allowing people to make their claims, really asking about where they were, when they were, what day it was, and listening to the answers and then going and testing it mm-hmm. rather than simply shouting and screaming mm-hmm. and accusing and disbelieving. It's a complete change of mindset in the interviewing thing. And the interview should be seen as one piece of a whole investigatory package.
Interesting. So I hadn't planned on this question, but and I'm not going to surprise you. But one of the things that I think is interesting that we're seeing more and more in human rights really is a need for diverse skill sets. And so human rights has often been dominated by lawyers, and we haven't been able to take advantage of different areas. And one of the things, so when I used to work for NGOs and we used to run investigations, we always used to try and get a police officer in to head the team because, well, they knew what they were doing from an investigative perspective. Yeah. What are the kind of skills you think a police officer brings to a human rights, well, the human rights world or human rights investigations?
First of all, his or her knowledge of the practical skills mm. and how policing works. You understand instinctively how a police officer thinks and why a police officer may react the way he or she does in a set of circumstances, which other people wouldn't necessarily understand. But interestingly for me, where I have gained is if I am in another country talking to a senior police officer about wrongdoing or alleged wrongdoing or about improving training or whatever it happens to be from a human rights perspective, I have found it much more useful when I've got a background in policing and I'm not just a young NGO rep straight out of university without experience. I can say to the chief of police, look, I've done your job. I understand your problems. I've experienced those problems myself. But do you know there's a different way of doing that? Mm. Do you know in another country, which sometimes I could name, they do it differently?
Mm-hmm.
And because you've got the experience, they are, I think, more inclined to listen to what you've got to say. Mm. So policing is just one example of that. But I think if human rights were to open up to more diversity and have people with the knowledge and skills and the voice, it would give them better access to the things they're trying to influence.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense, I guess, in terms of credibility and being able to speak the language.
Credibility is the word, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. And what are some of the difficulties that come up in terms of conducting interviews? Because I've never conducted a police interview, surprisingly enough, but I'd imagine it's quite a difficult process, particularly if you're under, you know, maybe a time pressure or political pressure to get results quickly. And I'd also imagine that the boundary that, well, what say forcefulness or, you know, coercive that verges on illegality is probably quite easy to understand. You know, torture is a relatively straightforward thing, but there must also be a grey area between a forceful interview and an illegal interview. You know, there must be a...
Yeah, there is a grey area between. But there are, in many countries, as are in the UK, rules about you shouldn't promise things and you shouldn't lie in your interviews and promise things you're unable to promise. So it's conducted, another word for this are ethical interviews. Some people who work on this call them ethical interviews. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a good word because it describes they should be honest. But the thing with interviews, you will sometimes be pressured to get an early result, politically or by the public. If there's been some horrific mm-hmm. event, members of the public may be baying for blood and want to see somebody in court the next day. Well, the person who's accused or who is suspect has got just the same rights as any other accused or suspect. And of course, if you go into it too heavy, unprepared, and you don't listen to what you're told, you could end up with miscarriages of justice mm-hmm. where you don't actually find the truth. you just make this person fit the position you think they should fit. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of, and if these rules exist, police officers themselves can say, well, we don't have to do that. We were told we must take our time. We're told we must prepare. Mm-hmm. It will give them protection.
That's an interesting point.
Properly
it's
as well.
Almost as a buffer.
Well, the interesting thing for me, I was still serving when the interview rules started to be adopted in this country, and they were adopted very enthusiastically. But I still recall even now that some of the old school, dare I say, detectives were a bit resistant, mm-hmm. Were a bit suspicious, and didn't think complying with the new rules was necessarily the best thing. But interestingly, after 2 or 3 months, a very short space of time, when we saw people conducting interviews to the new rules, which were protective, they suddenly found we were getting results where mm-hmm. people were admitting things, giving information. They weren't being threatened, they weren't being mistreated or whatever, but just treating the interviewee as an equal human being in a conversation, found we were getting more detections than we might otherwise have got.
That's interesting. So when I was thinking of it, when you were talking there, I thought, well, it might be the case that they're more effective in the long run, because say you don't end up with problems in court and maybe an acquittal or something. But you're also suggesting that they're more effective potentially in the short term too, immediately, just as an interview technique.
In both ways, they're more effective. So I was giving you a short-term example, but your long-term one about less acquittals, if you've actually stuck by the rules and you've treated somebody properly, there are less grounds there for a lawyer in court to challenge what you've done or how you've done it, or allege that the admission was actually tricked or beaten out of a person and it's an untrue one.
That's interesting. One of the things, maybe just to digress a little bit, but one of the issues that comes up in the context of torture a lot is the idea that, you know, there's a ticking time bomb and you need to do something in the short term to get results. I guess I'd just be interested to know what you think about that, particularly in terms of the utility of any information that could be achieved, you know, and whether it's in principle an effective technique or not.
I'm conversant with the ticking bomb scenario, and I'm conversant with particularly one case in Germany where a detective took steps that he shouldn't have taken, which went to the European Court. But I would say to you, even in those circumstances, a proper ethical interview is still the right thing to do. For example, if I suspected you assaulted somebody and they were dying, but I didn't know where they were, I was trying to recover the body before they died. In an ethical interview, I would say that to you. I believe you know, and I would ask you to tell me. And I could very politely point out to you in a very civilised way that if you didn't tell me, but we later established that you knew where they were and you had failed to tell me, we would tell the court that were the case, because you have the opportunity in telling me now to prevent that person dying. And you could do that quite civilly without threats. Mm. And if you have a rational conversation with somebody, there is always the argument they might think, you know, you're right, perhaps I should tell you, because I might then be charged with an assault, not necessarily of a murder if that person dies.
Yeah, so instead of threatening or abusing, it's just laying out the practical consequences.
Yeah.
This interesting.
Yes, exactly.
So one of the questions then, I suppose, is that the next process in terms of the guidelines themselves, you'll get a draft in February or March. What happens then?
Well, all of us on the advisory committee will get to give them some feedback. But having given so much feedback through the system, I'm very hopeful that the guidelines I get will be acceptable to me, always accepting that they're going to be an amalgamation of ideas and we could have expressed things differently. When they're in the final shape according to the project and the project is happy that it's developed what it's aiming to develop, I guess then they go back to the UN Security Council under the guise possibly of the current Special Rapporteur. I'm not sure, but they'll go back to the Security Council, and the idea is they'll be published as a non-treaty instrument.
Yeah, and I suppose the interesting thing then is that will be important itself as a resource, and I guess it's immediately useful, say, to a court if they're examining how an interview was conducted. But the next step, I suppose, is making them, or selling is the wrong word, but raising awareness of the guidelines themselves with different police forces.
Oh, selling is the right word.
Well, how does that happen?
Well, I don't know exactly, other than I know that the project in its final phase has got up its sleeve aims at politically getting countries to come on board with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine, I don't know the case, but I imagine training will be offered and advice will be offered. But the guidelines are going to be rather like the other ones. I can't remember what they are now, but where the law is in the guidelines and the practice. So it's, mm-hmm. these are the rules you should follow. And by the way, turn over. These are the sorts of things that you should do, and this is how you should interview. So it should come almost as a standalone piece of kit. But we, through the UN, have got to find a way, like all with all the other pieces of international law, is encouraging countries to toe the line and abide by it. And of course, sadly, ultimately, those that choose not to do that will be brought online through appearances between regional courts or complaints made through the UN system or so on. I mean, I hope it doesn't come to that, because mm-hmm. in essence, these rules are written to protect individuals being interviewed, but are also written to make the interviewer's job easier.
Mm.
And if somebody reads what the document is going to say, there's no reason to say, this isn't for me, this isn't going to work, I won't toe the line because this is not right for me. I think most reasonable people will read it and see that compliance is the best thing to do, because from a policeman's point of view, you will get a result. You will have a conversation, you will determine whether that person's involved or not, and you stand a good chance of getting a conviction and not something that is challenged in court or thrown out where you've misbehaved.
So you've anticipated my next question, I guess. It seems like with these types of documents, the challenge is always going to be buy-in. And phrasing them or framing them in such a way that police officers or interviewers, interrogators see them as something that's useful to them and not as an extra burden that's imposed on them. You know, another regulation coming down from the UN that gets in the way of them trying to do their job. So you've deliberately tried to anticipate that in terms of how the process is undertaken.
Yep. Because we know what the problems are. We know there'll be resistance. Any organisation resists change.
Of course. Yeah.
If they see this change is not an inhibitor, but an enhancer,
mm-hmm.
there is more chance it will be adopted with some degree of speed and enthusiasm. But of course, there's going to be the need to promote it, and, mm-hmm. and there will be steps with the project to promote it.
Oh, interesting. And just as a question, in terms of the advisory board, I had a look earlier on, and it's quite an impressive group of people and a large group of people.
It is
as
a large
well.
Group, yeah.
Are there many police or people with specific experience apart from yourself?
I know on the list there is someone who works in one of the oversight bodies in South Africa, I think.
Okay.
But there's a whole range of disciplines, as you've seen for yourself. And I came into the frame simply because of my dissertation work here. And the fact that for the past 10 years I've been working in the field of policing mm-hmm. and human rights. And so there are people that know me and thought I would have a useful voice.
Yep.
And I think I do have a useful voice because, again, one of my jobs, funnily enough, in Essex Police was for a couple of years I was head of training.
Okay.
So I understand the critical role that training has. I understand it has to be delivered in a way that those who receive it accept it and are prepared to believe it and buy into it. And I'm equally conscious that in times like now when money is tight, training is an easy cut to make mm-hmm. because it's an easy saving in the short term. In the long term, there are dire implications. So I think we're aware of that too.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a really useful skill set and a really, really interesting project. I look forward to reading it myself when it comes out. I had a final question, I think, just building on what you were saying there, and it relates to, well, you were talking about demonstrating the utility of a different approach that people can often, I think we all are, intuitively kind of hesitant with change, maybe a bit skeptical.
Yep.
How do you think, or do you think there are any lessons that could be applied from that in terms of the acceptability of human rights more broadly? I think, say, particularly in the UK at the moment, but internationally as well. You know, human rights is a bit of a, I wouldn't say a dirty word, but it's not always a very popular concept. How do we bridge that gap, you know, and demonstrate its utility, its practical utility?
With some difficulty, because in a law enforcement agency or in a military agency, there's a natural aversion to human rights because of all the baggage on the label. People don't necessarily understand what it was. But with a smile, I'll recount an interesting experience I had quite early on. I was actually working with the International Committee of the Red Cross at a time when the police service in Northern Ireland was being restructured after the end of the euphemistically labelled Troubles. And I went to Northern Ireland and witnessed some of their training of their police officers. And
is this the new training or the old?
The new.
Okay, yeah.
And the interesting thing for me, the way they got their police officers to understand the value and importance of human rights, they did a session which was called The Human Rights of Police Officers. Mm. And they explained and spelt out how existing human rights law as it was then applied to police officers. In other words, things like they deserve protection and the rest of it. And this was an eye-opener. And the fact they were subject and had the protection of human rights they hadn't previously appreciated. And I think that helped some useful debates about, well, we have to be protected, our human rights have to be protected, perhaps we therefore ought to protect others. Mm. And that's a useful hook to use, I think.
Mm, interesting. That must have been an incredibly interesting time
to
be involved in policing, just because it was such a focal point, I guess, in terms of the transition out of the Troubles.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, but then other countries have had internal conflict where policing all but broke down and had to be rebuilt. And I think it's a case of having the right rules and parameters, but specifically the right leaders and managers, and having good training and good selection procedures. There's a whole basket full of things which come together. Very difficult to do. But if you're going to investigate crimes, there is absolutely no point in doing it wrongly, quickly, cheaply, because you will end up convicting the wrong people, acquitting the wrong people, or your work will be in vain because the court won't convict. They'll say there's too much for us to think about here. You haven't proved the case. So if you're going to investigate something, do it properly.
That's probably a good note to end this on. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to this episode of RightsCast from the University of Essex Human Rights Centre. You can subscribe and find more of our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow the Human Rights Centre blog at hrcessex.wordpress.com. We'll be back soon with more regular episodes.